Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you chose to tune in whatever format. My guest today is Walter Olson of the Cato Institute. He is a libertarian scholar and has focused on a number of really interesting issues over the course of his career. But the reason he's here today is to discuss a document that has emerged from the Manhattan Institute about our universities. So welcome, Walter Olson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So this is one of these manifestos that intellectuals are so fond of. Lots of signatures, and some of them kind of disturbing, I think, to people like you and me who, you know, there are names on this list who you were too polite to mention them in your rebuttal piece, but there are names on this list of people who should know better and whose participation is arguably kind of embarrassing. But let's let listeners in on what we're talking about. So you were responding to what?
It is styled the Manhattan Statement, which right then and there tends to associate it with the Manhattan Institute, under whose auspices it was published, a little more so than if it were given a different name. And it it is not the first, as you and I know, document to propose reforming universities or principles for reforming universities. That's old hat.
And absolutely.
Yeah. And as I say in my critique, if you only skimmed through and skipped over what I view as the core of the piece, but instead lingered on the laundry lists of principles that they wish universities might adopt, you know, we might be nodding in agreement for a lot of them. So that's not what I find so dangerous and iniquitous about this. Some of those principles include, you know, academic standards need to be of the highest rigor. There needs to be a proper tone of discussions on campus. There should truth should be elevated over ideology. You can see that we are getting here rapidly into platitudes or the sort of thing that someone once said. If you can't imagine someone actually firmly disagreeing with you, maybe you haven't formulated it as a controversial proposition that's worth really debating. But
well, wait, let me jump in right there, because I mean, that's an excellent point, but there's another point too, which is, when you say things like we should elevate truth over ideology, I mean, immediately any reasonable person would halt and say, well, of course, that's completely in the eye of the beholder. The other, you know, people on the other side would say exactly the same thing with equal passion, right?
Of course. And and I point that out. I say, you know, you could round up 1,000 faculty progressives that you and I might disagree with on a whole lot of substance, but they would commit to most of these platitudes. They might have a different interpretation of how they apply, you know, when it comes to like merit-based, that's another of the terms. Well, yeah, you know, talk with them, and they will find that they don't feel that they are against merit, and in many ways are, you know, will say that they're the ones. In fact, on almost all these issues, ideological adversaries will believe and sincerely that they are the ones upholding the rigor or the truth rather than ideology. So eye of the beholder is a phrase to keep in mind during a lot of the things we're going to be talking about. And it's how you get to where I find it to be so dangerous, because as I say, if you skimmed this, reading parts only of it, everyone might be nodding pleasantly saying, oh, I'm glad that we've got some, you know, very high abstraction level principles that might bring us all together. You know, as I said, who knew it was this simple? You know, for a matter of prescribing those five things.
Hey, we should elevate truth over ideology. Why didn't anybody think of that?
We would have done it years ago if we'd realized it was that simple. But so, in fact, the controversy is kicked down the road to how do you interpret the things. And when they are kept vague, as I say, consequences are few and minor if we're just talking about it in a discussion. If they are to be enforced on universities on penalty of what I call annihilating penalties, then all of a sudden, everyone should pay attention to the question of, okay, how well defined are these? What exactly would they mean in practice? And what does the eye of the beholder problem also mean in practice?
Right. So before we get to the solution that they are proposing for these various sins, I think it'd be good to just give a little bit of the flavor of what they're arguing here, because it isn't just that they issue a lot of platitudes about, you know, truth and so on and so forth. It is actually, this is an incredibly aggressive, and you even describe it in your piece as screechy, piece where they say, for example, you know, they say that the universities have kind of been at war with the ordinary working American for many years now. And then here's a quotation. Now the truth is undeniable. Beginning with the George Floyd riots and culminating in the celebration of the Hamas terror campaign, the institutions of higher education finally ripped off the mask and revealed their animating spirit, racialism, ideology, chaos. You know, that is the level of argumentation here. I mean, you know, no subtlety. I mean, truly a meat axe. Accusation, everybody in the university, the entire, all of academia is responsible for the acts of a few people.
Yeah, whatever you can find to have been tolerated, not necessarily promoted, but tolerated at the very most extreme instance in a famous institution, is guilty of all academia, even though as soon as you look at all academia, you realize that most of it is institutions that you don't know very well, you know, state colleges, religious institutions, small right. liberal arts colleges that are not seen as particularly political. You know, academia is this vast, vast area, and they repeatedly, and I go after them on this because they repeatedly take things that, you know, you might be able to associate with 5 or 10 places and claim that this is academia, a sector of many, many thousands of institutions.
Right. And some of them are just not at all unique to academia or even particularly identified with academia. So they go after academia because of COVID-19 restrictions. You know, talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I saw that and I thought, okay, this is fitting a pattern in which they are tracking conservative grievances against elites generally, whether or not they seem to have much connection with university governance. Now, of course, universities issued some COVID restrictions with respect to their role as employers and those who run dormitories and public meetings and auditoriums and things. But of course, so did other employers, so did others who ran lodging spaces and public meetings. Universities are distinguished by not being able to issue public health orders that affect any of the rest of us who are not part of their communities. And it's governments that do. And so again and again, it's as if someone is sitting watching cable TV program full of grievance and not nodding at, transgender operations for the underage. Well, you know, so they found a few universities that have medical schools, which generally are highly independent of what anyone in the chancellor's office at the university are doing. Those medical schools are, for many reasons, including financial, they're usually way off on their own. But as I say, look, if that is your number one grievance, most of that superstructure of medicine wasn't going on even at university hospitals, and the vast majority even of larger universities don't have medical schools. So why do these grievances get in except to fire up the troops to get them madder and madder and madder?
Let me interject and just say there are some things on their list, and I think you hinted at this a minute ago, there are some things on their list of grievances with which I'm broadly sympathetic. I do think that the universities have, for example, I wouldn't use this language, but they do criticize them for racial quotas in hiring, for ideological filters, for forcing people to provide statements about their commitment to diversity and DEI, and ruling out people who don't, where it's clearly an ideological litmus test for hiring. And so I oppose those things, obviously. But now let's come to their solution for this long list of grievances.
Okay. Well, the key paragraph is short enough that you could skip over it if you weren't paying attention, but it is the one about how to force universities rather than just urge them or exhort them to do these things. And that is that the President of the United States, right there, an unusual thing to put into an education reform, should draft and impose on the universities through every channel of their government relations down to accreditation. Accreditation would be yanked if they didn't do these things. And on through,
which is a death penalty.
And on through the range of federal interactions. And just if I could pause about that, because it's important, some of the federal interactions with universities are things like deciding where to put a research contract. Now, we can argue about whether or not you want to put it where it's actually getting the best research done. That would be my view in many cases. But many
of the other, just crazy talk.
but many of the other federal interactions with universities are instances where, as conservatives have urged correctly for so many decades, the money follows the students. The GI Bill, for example, says that after you've done your military service, you can take that effectively voucher, and you can not only go get a Hillsdale College or its equivalent. I don't know whether Hillsdale takes it, but you can go to a very, very conservative format school. You can go to a very liberal format school, a loosey-goosey one. You can go to a seminary and train to become clergy. And the money follows you, whichever of those choices you make. Now, I think that's actually, a great setup. I wish more of education followed the money followed the student setup. But again, they propose to cut off the ability of colleges to even take this portable voucher money unless they fall in line with what we're going to be hearing about in a couple of minutes. So the it says that penalty for breaking these principles should be complete loss of all public support in all of these categories. So it is, as you say, the institutional death penalty. It is annihilating, even for colleges that have kept quite a bit of distance and don't take things like National Science Foundation grants. It's a death penalty for them, too. We know that the Trump administration, and we'll get to the connection with their actual practice, I think, in a bit, the Trump administration has also viewed things like simply being permitted to bring in foreign students and have them get the foreign student visa is another federal permission that can be withdrawn at displeasure. So I'm not exaggerating when I say that even the colleges that have been careful to avoid government dependence and commitment would in fact find this to be a life or death matter, whether they were found to be in any way out of compliance with this.
If you're like me, you've noticed that getting older is full of little wake-up calls. You start seeing more hair in the drain, your part looks wider, and suddenly you're zooming in on old photos wondering if your hair was always this thin. That's why I'm really loving what OneSkin is doing. Their OS01 peptide has been transforming our skin here at the Mona Charon Show for a while. Now, with their new scalp serum, OS01 Hair, it's here to help us with hair loss, thinning, and shedding. Why would a skincare company create a scalp treatment? Well, because the scalp is skin, and just like the rest of your body, it experiences cellular aging. But instead of wrinkles, it messes with your hair follicles and natural growth cycle, leading to hair loss and thinning. OS1 Hair is the first scalp serum powered by OneSkin's OS01 peptide, which targets those aging cells called senescent cells, and it's scientifically proven to help your hair cells do what they're meant to do. Grow denser, fuller, healthier hair. Get to the root of hair loss and thinning with OS01 Hair. You'll save 15% on your first purchase with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. Anybody who knows me knows that I am really, obsess about personal appearance, but two things I'm really into are healthy teeth and healthy hair. So this is very important to me. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you. So rather than propose that there be boards of review or that state legislatures might want to take a more active role in examining what goes on in their own universities in their states, or, rather than suggesting more transparency, for example, about the way faculty hiring is done or any of those things, they reach out and say, the president of the United States, they don't name him, the president of the United States should be able by UCAS simply to declare that a university is not in compliance with these very vague principles, and kill them. And one of the points you make, and I'd like you to sort of expatiate on that now, is you say part of what is so dangerous and damaging about this is that it sort of retroactively endorses the kind of tactics Trump has already been using against universities.
Yeah. And I think that's no coincidence. I think it very much was meant to follow in the footsteps and to retroactively provide a policy justification in as much as it could for what Trump has already been doing. Now, we know that Trump has been using these nuclear weapons, these funding cutoffs, these visa cutoffs, in a peremptory way, front running any actual finding of misconduct by the colleges. That's the whole campaign kicked off with the announcement of fund withdrawals from universities on charges that had not been even presented to them, let alone time been allowed for them to respond and give their best to defense. And I want to step back for a moment and contrast it with the system that we have had up until Trump took office for the federal government imposing its will on universities through a combination of defunding threats and also various legal actions. Because even though I have often expressed discontent with that earlier system, which I thought was subject to a lot of government overreach and itself allowed the federal government to push around universities too much in many ways, it looks almost like a golden age now by comparison of due process and of reasoned discourse, because the general rules, and they've gone back and forth a little bit on some of the issues, like whether you have to target a defunding only at the particular part of the university that misbehaved, or whether you can target more. Separate from that, even during the most overbearing periods, there was a series of things that effectively protected the due process rights and the fair notice interests of the universities themselves. One of them, as I said, was that if they believed they had found a violation, that they would at some point have to put it in on paper, describing exactly what they had thought was wrong, how it violated the law, which law it violated, and so forth, presented to the university. Again, in these circumstances, if something punitive is about to happen to you, you want that bill of particulars of what you are supposed to have done wrong so that you can prepare the best defense. And then they were supposed to wait for the university to assemble its best defense and come back. And then they were supposed to put further findings, based on, okay, now we've seen the university's side of the story, and here's why it's not good enough, and maybe we'll drop two of the charges, but we think we've continued to prove. So there is this back and forth even before it gets to a court. And one of the important things about that is that that paper trail and that invitation for the best written version of what each side's case is meant that when it did get to court, because if they tried to cut off the university's funding, the university could sue over being arbitrary and capricious or whatever the legal standard was, then they...
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
A judge would then have a real file to work with. It wouldn't just be, it was the executive's will to cut them off. And so that was a tremendous protection, because it meant that if you had a vengeful bureaucrat in the federal government that had just taken out after you, you had some hope of landing before a judge at some point. And this is, Trump just ignored all of this. He also ignored some of the important procedures for pre-announcement. I mentioned that this was one of the things that really constitutes fairness in most people's eyes, is learning about what is illegal before you have to make your decision on what to do rather than afterward. And that plays in a couple of different ways. Sometimes when they knew they were trying to stretch the law, they would do some combination of rulemaking involving notice and comment, which is favored under federal law because it means that all the affected interests, which can be both the university and sometimes it can also be interests other than the university that might suffer from the rule, like students who might get expelled because the university is being told not to give them due process on Title IX or whatever. Anyway, everyone who feels that they have something to lose can come in and comment on notice and comment. The university, of course, can. And then the government gives that reasoned explanation of why. Now we've gone through notice and comment. Here are our reasons, and here are 8 things people argued against and why we disagree with them.
Yeah, let me drill down a little bit now on this. You said it a few times, notice and comment, and our non-lawyer viewers and listeners may not know what that's about. So it's really important. The federal government is governed by the Administrative Procedure Act. And the Administrative Procedure Act has all kinds of standards about how things must be done. And rulemaking by federal agencies is governed by the idea that you have to give notice and allow comment. So this is the notice and comment. That's why there's a Federal Register And the agency, you know, before it promulgates a rule saying that, you know, every cubicle at a factory has to have its own fan, you know, they then open it up and they say, you know, how would this affect, you know, they open it up for comments and people who, you know, can say pro and con. Have you considered this? Have you considered? That's how things are done. So that's one area of the law that allows those who are going to be affected by a proposed regulation opportunity to be heard. But there's another aspect of the Administrative Procedure Act that's incredibly important for preserving people's rights. And that is, there's a rule that the bureaucrat, and in this case, it would include the President of the United States, but any government actor cannot behave in an arbitrary or capricious manner. They have to have reasons, and they have to state their reasons for acting. And Trump has completely obliterated that idea. It is being challenged in the courts, but that takes time. But one of the things that is so dismaying about these intellectuals, and so let's give some of their names. So Christopher Rufo, of course, no shock. But Neil Ferguson, Ayaan Hirsi-Ali, Peter Wood, Rich Lowry, I don't know if he qualifies as an intellectual, but he was a magazine, he's a magazine editor, you know, who are basically inviting the government in the person of the president to just sweep away all of these protections that are part of the law.
You have said it. They are, you know, I reading down the list of signers, and some did not surprise me, but others did surprise me. I tried to figure out, you know, do people sign things hastily? Do they sign things that they only agree with part of? You know, to me, as one who does not generally sign joint letters, you know, right there, you've got two of the problems with joint letters and joint manifestos, which is that some of the people don't read them closely and some of them sign them even though they don't agree with all of them. Now, I don't mean to take us astray, but already on social media and Substacks and things, two of the signers have said, well, I didn't agree with all of it, but I thought that it was off in the right general direction. And
you want to tell us who those were?
No, I don't want to. But again, they've got a different philosophy than I do. I wouldn't sign something if I could possibly help it that involved proposing fitting of a straitjacket of a, you know, massively coercive thing on my colleagues if I were in the university world without agreeing with the most drastic and rights denying part of the document. I mean, it's one thing if they disagreed with a little of the over the top verbiage about universities making war on families or whatever, but so even they, you know, apparently from the first couple of examples I've had a chance to see, even the signers recognized that there were problems here. But so that fairness issue of both prior notice, and I'll throw in here that a lot of listeners will be aware that there were big controversies over so-called Dear Colleague letters as a way of regulating universities. And back when we were all writing articles about the dangers of Dear Colleague letters, one of them was that it was kind of bypassing some of this stuff by sending, by way of letters, things that they should have done in a more deliberate way. It was more bossy and you know, we may not have used the term dictatorial, but
brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax tip and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
But even the Dear Colleague letter, as much as we criticized them, were typically prospective only. They typically did make fairly clear we may have disagreed with the contents, and every so often we could find something vague. But the Dear Colleague letters mostly still stuck to the legality idea that they wanted to actually tell them what was required of them. And that is what has suddenly vanished. And that combination, and I don't mean to get too apocalyptic about it, but that combination of arbitrary punitiveness with no actual definition of the offense takes us into the kind of foreign country territory and certain kinds of foreign countries that have had certain types of regimes. That is the typical format of a country where people are afraid of the government, is that it's not just that they occasionally put out ridiculous regulations that you laugh at, but you know what the regulation means, is that they put out the equivalent of, you know, that bad Roman emperor who was said to have published new laws at the top of a high obelisk so that the public could not actually read them. So they didn't know what was being banned.
You know, this comes also hard on the heels of the capitulation by Columbia University. And once again, you have the sense these days in the Trump administration era of, you know, whole swaths of normal conduct of the way we do things just being thrown out the window. So Columbia, you know, is accused of anti-Semitism. By the way, I don't take this administration at face value in their opposition to anti-Semitism. I mean, they are close to Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, and Trump had dinner with Ye and Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, they're anti-Semites can be very useful to them in other circumstances. I doubt very much this is really, I think that's a fig leaf window dressing for what they really want to do, which is to attack their ideological enemies or whatever. But so Columbia is accused of anti-Semitism. And on those grounds, they go after contracts with the Department of Biology and the Department of, you know, other, you know, scientific parts of Columbia. Why? Well, you know, the sociology department doesn't have any contracts with NIH. But they do, you know, the science departments do have contracts with the federal government. So that's where the leverage is. But, you know, the federal government is in a contractual relationship with Columbia there. It isn't like saying, we, the federal government, dictate that you will study, you know, viruses and vaccines. It's not like that. It's a contract. They agree that we will, you know, you will get this grant, and in exchange, you will do this research. And here's our obligation, and here's your obligation. And guess what? In a contract dispute, you can't just abrogate your responsibilities, right? There are penalties for that sort of thing. So Columbia had a lot of legs to stand on here saying, well, wait a minute, you're in breach. And even if you're the government, you can't breach a contract without consequences. In very rare circumstances, you can, but those are involving matters of sovereignty. And, you know, it's like there's a war on, and therefore the, you know, government has changed its policy about, you know, but those are very narrow. I mean, the government can't just arbitrarily do that normally.
And that is one reason why in the Harvard case, for example, the judge made clear in some of her early rulings that she saw some of those issues the same way that you've just been describing them, and that the government was not free to yank contracts that were already in midterm, as opposed to renewals perhaps of contracts next year, without specific grounds for being able to tear them up. Now, I don't mean to get political, but I can't help saying that Donald Trump has taken the approach to contracts that he pursued as a casino builder and other things, namely that contracts he signed did bind the counterparty, which had to had to provide the flooring or the kitchens or whatever exactly as ordered. But the contracts did not prevent him from,
not paying
or attempting to redictate the terms on pain yes. of you want to spend the next 5 years with my lawyers. You're not even going to get back what I owe you. And so again, it's he has put this out now for a wide area of government expenditures. Again, some on programs that I would be happy to cut, except that you need to follow the law and the impoundment control action, all the rest of it. So he's just been totally willing to ignore the law on these things. And of course, a relationship that is already quite one-sided, that is the federal government versus universities. And it was one-sided during all of the previous administrations, too. They all felt that they had to generally follow what Washington wanted. But it becomes grossly lopsided when what obligations there are on the federal side, it no longer needs to respect.
Right. So in a moment like this, it seems to me that intellectuals have a special obligation and responsibility to be willing to, call out the government when it is overstepping its bounds, and to recognize when government is becoming authoritarian. And some of these people on the list, certainly, made their careers opposing authoritarian regimes around the world and, celebrating. I mean, one of the things they're so keen to have us all, have a very rah-rah version of American history, and that, this is the land of freedom. This is the land of opportunity, all of that. Well, they by failing, arguably, to respond to challenges to what makes America great, that is our freedom and our liberty to say as we what we want, free of government coercion, they're showing such partisanship, nearsightedness, what would you call it?
Toward the end of the piece I wrote for The Unpopulist, I went after them a little bit on that point and a couple of related points, because I mean, we all know that one of the things going on here is that there is a particular conservative movement critique of the universities, and the signers of this Manhattan Statement represent a bunch of different flavors of conservative. I am sorry to say that some of them even apparently characterize themselves as libertarian, which makes me want to go cry in the corner or hide my head in a bag. But leaving aside that, and I left out that one because I figured if you haven't figured out as a libertarian, you're not supposed to be endorsing this. I'm not sure I can help you at this point. But a second group, and I really do see this as the one that has the most responsibility otherwise, is the group you named, which is people who came into public life to warn us about the sorts of societies out there where intellectuals could not make a living as intellectuals because the economic oxygen hoses stepped on by the right people in the capital, by the party in control or whatever, and we know that continues to be in this world a terrible, terrible source of oppression. And more than one of the voices here were important voices in focusing us on let's not take for granted the freedom that America has, that it's not an authoritarian country. And here they are. I don't remember Dante's Circles of Hell, because I'm not a Dante reader, but I remember that there was this gradation of levels of excuse. You know, also in there are people who made their whole careers talking about basically Western civilization, and I care more about Western civilization than you do. Well, you know, I was kind of sympathetic to a lot of that, because I also think that Western civilization, you know, is crucial to the things that we inherit. Well, you know, did they do enough reading to know that the independence of the universities is one of the key things that made Western civilization arise, and that continues to differentiate it from parts of the world where the universities are more under the thumb of the kings and sultans and party chairmen. And the so they have a lot to answer for, too, if they want to go on being the slightly superior seeming, you know, I've spent more time thinking about preserving Western civilization than you have. You know, I'm not going to believe them soon if they go on with that line. And then yet a third group, or fourth, if you want to count the libertarians, is the people who believe, with a lot of Catholic conservatives, but also people from many other faith traditions, that mediating institutions and the intrinsic diversity that you get by allowing mediating institutions to be different from each other and powerful in people's lives and allowing people to commit to the intermediate institutions, something that makes the central government less powerful, something that decreases your chances of being rolled into some sort of totalitarianism, because many of those institutions use their independence to push back if someone tries to affix a totalitarian scheme. You know, I went through life, and although it wasn't my own tradition, I was nodding at some of the better writers in that area, saying, you know, I never saw it that way, but they are right that part of what keeps societies free is that respect is paid to the independence of these institutions and their right to be different. And then you turn to this, this wretched proposal that they have, and you look at the way in which it irons out with a steamroller. It tiptoes around the very existence of religious colleges and universities. Well, why does it do that? In part because it's very clear that those are among the things that will be most fraught as far as someone thinking that something is true versus just a system of belief. You know, religious colleges exemplify what I would argue is also true for some other kinds of colleges, which is that they want the right to pursue ideals into the classroom and to pursue the ideals out into the general world afterward. They want the light of learning to be able to shine in a moral way and not just in a calculating way on the problems of the outside world. And so one of the planks of the Manhattan Statement is that in their view, although it's for the moment, it's still okay in their view for professors or students to endorse controversial views. They believe that universities themselves must never, on pain of losing all federal funding, make any moral statements or generalizations or statements about social justice or statements about injustice in society. Now, I happen to be an advocate for most applications of so-called institutional neutrality. I actually think it's a good idea for the Harvards and Yales and for the state universities and for other reasons, and for most liberal arts colleges to listen to the people who've been urging them, you know, pull back from the sorts of things you were saying during the George Floyd thing and let that be the province of your scholars. So I start out generally being sympathetic, you know, when it comes to like 80% of the educational institutions. But the idea of abolishing those that are driven by a mission, those that do believe that one particular religion has a special light to offer the world, and iron them out with that steamroller, where do these people get that idea? Mm-hmm. Not from America.
No. And, you know, and it's particularly, just to use a marker to underline your previous point on this,
brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
These are people who we read for many years, and they talked about how important it was that there be something between the individual and the state. And they kept saying that people like Obama and people like the Democrats were trying to obliterate that distinction and to make it all about the individual and the state and to ignore the rich, layered nature of our societies and all these different institutions. And also that they had a lot of skepticism about the wisdom of state power and the justice of state power. And the point was you wanted it to be much more limited because of its tremendous capacity for evil. I mean, that's what made me a conservative when I was growing up, was the idea that, yes, I recognize there are times when government can do good, but I was far more attuned to the things it could do that were evil. And therefore, I wanted to keep its power limited. And that's why I thought the founders had it, you know, had great ideas. Okay. Now these people who spouted all of that for so long are now saying, yeah, never mind. I mean, we want the president of the United States to come at this with a scepter, a sword and a scepter, where he is the lone decision maker and where he has the absolute power over this key part of American society and presumably others.
And that's beautifully put. And if I could pursue that point a little bit further about the role of the president and personalist government, which is a term that I learned only fairly recently, but which it fits so well that I go on using it. You know, we are getting into a personalist regime, and the signers of this appear to be okay with this being part of that. But it makes you miss bureaucracy. You know, the idea had been on both sides that however bad the regulation and the bureaucracy could be, it was unlikely that anyone in the White House or anyone in Washington at all could pick up the phone and issue an order saying, this professor, get rid of them. This student, get rid of them for writing an op-ed or whatever. And the reason they couldn't was a double bureaucracy. The federal government itself was so bureaucratic that it would probably dissipate in the different layers of the organizational structure. You know, sometimes, as with tax audits, you have an outright rule that the president can order it, ignored, of course, by the president. But in many other cases, you have a combination of bureaucratic practices and usages and mores that would keep that from happening. And if for some reason such a call were placed to the university, then the university's bureaucracy would also dissipate the thing, because who's ever tried to get action out of university bureaucracy? It's almost impossible. So that professor or that student was probably not going to be touched for a good long time. Maybe there'd be a new administration in office. Now, look at the system proposed by this, and you have both bureaucracies collapsing into telephone calls. And I keep getting back to telephone calls because in the bad old days of the Soviet Union, it was known that things that officially were being handled by courtroom process were being handled by telephone calls to the judge. And that has recurred lately during the coverage. I think it was the Washington Post, although it might have been the New York Times, which said that major orders are being given in the Trump administration by telephone calls, because they don't want to put anything at all, even on email, even in texting. They don't want any written record whatsoever of the things that they want done.
And, mafia style.
Yeah, well, and this flattens the various institutional boundaries, including the requirement of a writing, which stood between us and that phone call from someone on the White House staff saying, this professor has to go.
Yeah. There's another aspect to this, it's this. These people who are so furious at wokeness and at the, you know, what they see as the takeover of the universities by radicals, there is a fundamental lack of immodesty there. It never crosses their mind to think that actually we need open inquiry. We need to make sure everybody is given their opportunity to speak, because we might be wrong. We may think we know, but we may not know. Right? And when you read through this, there is this certainty. They are absolutely ready to impose the truth, right? As they see it.
Yeah, and you know, Mona, as you know, and as I think you would say, this is something we have in common. We both came out of years and years spent in right-of-center circles in which we deeply identified with some of the dissidents in academia, some of the more conservative thinking people who were often under terrible pressure. In whatever the discipline was, and even in the disciplines that were a little more friendly, you had Federalist Society type law professors, you know, under tremendous pressure and finding it very hard to make their way. And even in economics, you have, you know, the George Mason University economics department as a shining example of the free market stuff. And then you had elsewhere. And I can't tell you how many times I've had occasion to think, you know, I'm so glad that America has the kind of decentralized system that allowed for the rise of the University of Chicago Law School back when it was producing Scalia and Bork and Easterbrook and all these people. I'm so glad that even the state system is sufficiently decentralized that a state that is not super conservative just would have one state college, namely George Mason, that tolerated having a super great, if I can put it that way, economics department. Well, so what does the Trump administration make its latest hobby? It wants to fire the president of George Mason University, not, yeah, of course, for being too close to Trump's views. Apparently, he is some kind of liberal. But, you know, do they really think that waving a flag for the liberal left, saying George Mason University no longer deserves any academic freedom or independence, you think they're not going to use that to go after the free market economists there? You know, if you want our academic freedom respected, you need to make it a mutual kind of peace treaty.
Yeah. All right. I think we will leave it there. Walter Olson, thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to join you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets, with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.